Some couples deal with the emptiness syndrome that occurs when their children start to leave home by buying a dog or taking up golf. But when the oldest of Melissa Faye Green's four biological children left for college, she and her husband decided to adopt another child. And they didn't stop until they'd added five children to their family, one from Bulgaria and four from Ethiopia. She tells this story in her latest book, No Biking in the House Without a Helmet. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux under the Sarah Crichton imprint, and I'm very pleased it has brought her back to our show today. Hello.
Hi, Lenny. Thank you.
Have any of your children read this book? Did you give them veto power over the stories that they might not have wanted to see in print?
I did. They did read it. The older kids, yes, a lot of them read it all the way through, vetoed stories. I had great...
Because they would be embarrassed
to
know about it?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I set out in that way to make sure that my children would still be speaking to me when I finished the book. Like my oldest daughter's punk rock years that began when she was about 15, I had some fabulous material there. And I had it in the book proposal and was about to ship off the book proposal to publishers. And I suddenly thought I better ask her. And I texted her to say, though, you know, you're... That when you were going to shave off your hair and dye what was left pink, and can I write about that? And the text came flying right back, no. But in fact, before the book was published, she turned around and said, no, let's. Why don't we look at some of that? And there are a couple of punk rock chapters.
Well, other people knew about that, all the her schoolmates and people who knew the family. So in an odd way, being a respected journalist, I'm sure you had to consider that as well. Do you tell the story accurately, the story that or do you just wind up cleaning everything up?
That was the most delicate question all the way through, how to write something that was real and true and yet not so deeply private that it was, you know, parting all our curtains and inviting everyone to see everything. So the book is a mix of that.
Go ahead.
I tell it through my own eyes, so it's how things struck me. And so I'm the one in the front lines, and I'm the one in the pages saying this, I was really worried this time, or this really scared me. So it's more about my reactions. The kids come off pretty well.
How many of them are still living at home?
Five.
All the adopted ones.
Yeah, this would have been our empty nest year. I came right up to the edge with old friends, and we sent off our children to college, and they went off, you know, and went on cruises or did whatever, and we've still got a seventh grader.
Does adopting yet another one ever tempt you, or are you stopping at nine?
We're stopping at nine, yeah.
Although the book has a lighthearted title and contains many funny stories, it also touches on some serious issues, like your experience dealing with post-adoption depression. What led to your becoming depressed soon after you returned home with your first adopted child, who was a four-year-old Bulgarian boy, a Bulgarian Romney boy?
Romney, that's Romney, the proper word for gypsy, which is not the right
named
word. Jesse. I think it was exhaustion that tilted me into depression and the feeling that this didn't feel anything like when we brought the other children home from the hospital, which I was waking my husband up in the middle of the night to tell him while sobbing. And
this wasn't like postpartum depression.
It is. It is like it, actually. I mean, people feel that it is similar, but I hadn't had that. And I'd never had depression at all. I didn't know anything about depression. So I didn't know what was happening to me. What I thought was that I had ruined my life and the life of my family.
That's by bringing the stranger into your home.
Yes, because he didn't feel like my own child, and you suddenly start wondering, when is someone going to come pick this child up? Because this is a lot of work, and I don't even know the kid.
Well, he was 4 years old, so
yeah.
He already came with a certain amount of emotional baggage.
He did, and he'd been in a Eastern European institution for a few years, so there were things about him that scared me, even though I'd read about it in advance. It was different than living through it. So, for example, he fell one day and cracked his head against the brick fireplace, but then just hopped up and kept on running. So I thought he hadn't hurt himself. But then when I was putting him to bed that night, I saw that he had a gash, a deep, bloody gash, and he hadn't cried. So I knew about that from reading about it, that institutionalized children learn not to cry because no one comes and you just feel worse. But then to actually see it, you know, and he would rock.
But can you teach him to cry?
Well, oh, God, he cries now. Yes, yes, yes. But it was a learned behavior that no one cared. And so just seeing things like that made him seem far from anything I knew.
And you said he also rocked, which is a kind of a form of self.
Yeah, he would sway back and forth. It is. Yeah.
You've written extensively about international adoption. Have you come across other parents who had similar experiences with post-adoption depression and then children who had to go through this reacculturation?
Yes. I think the essay that I first wrote about it, which becomes a chapter in this book, Post-Adoption Panic, I think that I was one of the first adoptive parents to be out there with this because I'm a journalist and I had access to magazines and so on. So it was really like breaking a code of silence in a way. People feel shame about it, as I think mothers who have postpartum depression do. You've spent months or years trying to bring this child home. You've spent money. You've had lawyers. You've done all of this. Now the child's in your house, and all you're thinking is, oh, my God, what have I gotten myself into?
And Tom Cruise is going to make fun of me.
Well, he's an adoptive parent.
No, but he...
Oh, yes, made fun of postpartum depression. Yes.
Well, so how long after you had brought Jesse home did you decide to adopt another child? I guess you got over the depression.
I did. You know, the depression, it felt like it lasted about 4 years. And if I look at it on the calendar, it was about 3 weeks. But it was the longest 3 weeks of my life because I thought I'd ruined everything. He adjusted. He was happy. The older kids were thriving. Then another child of ours grew up and moved away from home. And we were back to just three kids at home. And it felt like the numbers were falling too quickly. At that moment, the African HIV/AIDS pandemic and the orphan crisis was in the news. I researched and wrote about that in the book, and I came here to talk to you about it. There is no me without you, about the AIDS orphan crisis.
And an Ethiopian orphanage run by a woman named Haragwin Tefera.
Exactly.
Who I think came here as well. I know.
She did come to New York, actually. Yeah. She was in New York to win an award. So, you know, here I'm suddenly confronted with 25 million orphaned children. And I thought, well, we've got an extra twin bed upstairs. And that then took us into a different direction and led to us having four children from Ethiopia.
Were you concerned that adopting another child might cause another post-adoption depression?
Yes, I was terrified. And there was only one academic researcher looking at the syndrome, and I emailed her. We'd already committed to a 5-year-old girl named Helen, but I emailed this woman and said, so listen, if you've had post-adoption depression once, you probably don't get it again, right? You know? And she emailed back and said, oh, no, you could get it again.
And that must have been reassuring.
Though it was really scary. And I did have just a moment of it with Helen, but it passed.
And Helen, you've been told, was an especially bright and social child. So that perhaps made her a better candidate. How old was she?
You know, what was the difference between our son from a Bulgarian orphanage and our four Ethiopian children was that the four had all started life in loving families. They were just regular kids. They'd had chores and siblings and pets, and two of them used to ride horses, but their families had been wiped out by AIDS. So these were children, although they'd known grief, they'd also known family life, and they adapted much more quickly than poor Jesse, who'd been in an institution and hadn't really known the love of parents.
So you could integrate them into your
family. It just happened
family.
A lot faster. They were used to having...
Even though they were also from foreign countries, and in the case of the Ethiopians, a different color.
Right. The Ethiopian children came with just phenomenal gifts that turned out to be of great interest to their peers. Not only were they, I mean, some of it's a cliche, fabulous runners, and fantastic soccer players, but Saul, when he first came, would go into the woods and carve a spear, and he knew how to hunt animals. And we discovered that when our teenage son Lee threw up a frisbee, and Saul could throw this spear and pierce the frisbee in midair. You know,
you got it winds up costing a lot of money in new frisbees,
and yes.
My guest is Melissa Fay Green. Her latest book, No Biking in the House Without a Helmet. She is probably best known for Praying for Sheetrock, which was a bestseller. Where did this title come from? I can guess where it comes from.
I know. I started in a way collecting the ridiculous things you accidentally say to your children. And in fact, other people have been sending me things. But I had a couple, for example, I want you to hit each other outside, I said to the children once. And on another occasion, I said, please don't wrestle with the scissors near the baby. And this was just, you know, one of those ridiculous things. Saul had actually dragged a tiny bicycle into the house and was riding it. And I said, no biking in the house. So he turned right and rode down the basement stairs. And I yelled, you're not wearing a helmet. And it just seemed like the kind of thing that would relay a certain lightheartedness.
And there was a certain amount of fighting that occurs, especially when with the two boys of the same age, so-called artificial twins.
I knew going into it that artificial twinning is highly not recommended in the adoption world, but Saul was already in the family. He was 13. My son Lee was in Ethiopia volunteering in a number of orphanages, and he called us about these two brothers, Joseph and Daniel, and said, please, please, they're like my brothers already. They would be perfect for our family. So we said, all right, we'll adopt them, you know. At that moment, the younger children are saying, wait, we've been asking you for years if we could have a ferret, and you always say, no, it's too much responsibility. And now Lee calls and says, can we adopt two boys from East Africa? And you say, yes. And I said, you're right, that is not fair. And the younger one said, so can we have a ferret? I said, no, it's too much responsibility. But it did give us two tough, street smart 13-year-old boys. And there was the fighting for the alpha position.
Saul and Daniel alternate between pounding each other and not speaking to each other.
Yeah.
And even though they're both from Ethiopia and have share all sorts of other things. But as you learned later, they had family histories that perhaps made the whole situation a lot more complicated than simply they have been orphaned by HIV/AIDS.
We had stayed in touch. We are in touch with Saul's grandmother. She's actually an elderly woman he calls grandmother. And so whenever I was traveling to Ethiopia for reporting, when Lee was there, we always saw Sahai, this tiny little sweet grandmother. We all went back in 2007. She was thrilled, screaming, praying, welcoming everyone, and didn't even realize her grandson was there. He had grown so much and was wearing a big, you know, glossy soccer jersey. She was ecstatic. She got a message to his home village, and his birth mother, whom we had been told was deceased, walked 3 hours to reach a road and then rode by bus 10 hours to the capital and had a reunion with him. We didn't realize the woman was alive, but it's all working, and we now have essentially open adoptions with all five of our internationally adopted children.
One of them is a girl.
Yes.
Could you have done this if your own biological children hadn't really been so helpful?
No. If the older kids were sad or displaced or felt neglected, it would have been hard to proceed. But now our oldest four, three are in their 20s, one's in college. They come home, and it's like they're visiting the land of their own childhoods.
Well, you mentioned that Jesse didn't know how to cry. Your son, Seth and Lee, taught him how to play after he arrived from Bulgaria.
They did. One of the first things we noticed about Jesse was there was no imagination. There was no playfulness. He'd been in these grim orphanages. And when I first visited him, I pulled out a little rubber weasel dressed in a frock and carrying a picnic basket to see. I was thinking, this is a funny toy. What will he... And he whirled around, grabbed a broom, and tried to beat the thing to death. Like there was nothing imaginary about it. When he first came to Atlanta, I say that he was following the older children around like an anthropologist exploring strange customs. The trampoline, he couldn't get the point of it. He couldn't get the essence. But one day, Seth, who was then 15, gave Jesse a balloon. And Jesse said, ba-oon, ba-oon, happy. And Seth brought him to the bathroom, put him on a stool, and showed him he could fill it with water. And then he tied it off. So here's this big, fat, jiggly water balloon. And Jesse's eyes are as huge as this big, round, green thing. Then Seth lured him out to the deck and showed him, helped him again climb up, and showed him to push it off the deck. And the beautiful water balloon fell and smashed onto the driveway. And I'm watching this thinking, really? That didn't look like a good plan. I thought Jesse was going to throw one of his fits at this. But Jesse turned around with a look on his face that expressed to me, what a wonderful country. And then spent the next hour with Seth blowing up water balloons. And that was the beginning of that you could do something only because it was fun.
Well, even though they were coming in many cases from less than happy situations, I'm assuming all of them experienced homesickness to varying degrees. And you write about how your younger daughter Lily helped Helen get through her initial homesickness.
She did. Helen was the saddest. She had lost her mother about less than a year earlier, and she had been her mother's chief caregiver. And as she was able to express more and more to us, she would just, and she was the tiniest, little, most feminine, sweet child, and tears would roll down her cheeks, why my mother had to die. And I had an Ethiopian babysitter, so she was able to relay that to us immediately through translation. And I would just hold her and cry, and we would both cry, you know.
But your daughter could do something that you couldn't do as an adult because she was a peer?
Lily and Helen absolutely bonded from the first moment, and Lily was the first person. Lily was then, I guess, about 10 or 11, and Helen would whisper to Lily and confide in Lily. It was all in Amharic, but Lily would just nod and listen and hold Helen, and they are just infinitely close.
Now, you've mentioned that you live in Atlanta. Isn't there a very large Ethiopian population there?
There is. It's been a wonderful—
How did that happen?
It's just one of the great settlement cities for East Africans. We've got close to 20,000 Ethiopian and Eritrean immigrants. So for all my Ethiopian children, although they're far from their country, they're very much a part of the Ethiopian diaspora. They play sometimes with an Ethiopian soccer team. They go to Ethiopian restaurants all the time, just on their own. Some of them are driving now. So they're still part of the Ethiopian people. They speak Amharic.
And some of those Ethiopian children of yours turned out to be great athletes.
They are. I have a chapter entitled The Jewish Guide to Raising Star Athletes. And the first line is, all right, we had to adopt to get athletes. Now, that's a chapter I had to clear with my biological children. It's not like they haven't noticed that suddenly coaches know our names. Coaches are calling us from all over the region. The kids are all on these traveling, fabulous teams. Three of the boys are going to Israel this summer as part of an international Jewish soccer team.
Well, I'm assuming now that all of these kids have become Americanized. Not everybody thinks that's the best thing, and there are people who even object to international adoption in general. What are your feelings about that?
The children are all thriving. They're Ethiopian Americans. They have incredibly diverse circles of friends. In our high school, there are kids from 58 different countries. These are not kids that were adopted. These are refugee families, immigrant families, CDC, Centers for Disease Control families. So among our kids' closest friends are white Americans and also kids from all sorts of African nations. So it's a very diverse world they live in. I've said that our family is more like Arizona than Arizona. We've got a couple of aging whites, and there's a young, incredibly diverse, lively generation growing up.
But none of these children were Jewish originally, so.
No, they were not. And they've, by choice, they've converted to Judaism. They're Jews by choice.
I should tell everyone that Melissa Faye Green will be giving a reading and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store on 82nd Street and Broadway. You've made a kind of a habit coming here on book tours.
You're my favorite.
But do you write books to get out of Atlanta? Is that what happened?
No, I love writing the books. This part is hard for me. One has a quiet, solitary life as a writer, and suddenly you have to hit the road.
Well, you do have a whole bunch of kids who can distract you.
Yes.
Melissa Faye Green is the author of Praying for Sheetrock, The Temple Bombing, Last Man Out, and There Is No Me Without You. Praying for Sheetrock was one of the top 100 works of journalism in the 20th century, named that by NYU's journalism department. She's written for many other publications, and now her latest book is No Biking in the House Without a Helmet, published by the Sarah Crichton imprint of Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being with us
again. Thank you so much, Lenny.